Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in today to the Strength in Recovery podcast. We are in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, which is right outside of Pittsburgh. Can I say that?
Yes.
Would you call this a suburb of Pittsburgh?
I would call this Pittsburgh.
You would call this that works too.
Nobody knows where Monroeville is.
I know Monroeville because I've been here a few times now, and I am obsessed with Big Rig Barbecue.
Yes.
Any takers on that?
That's our go-to for barbecue in the area. We actually live not far away from it.
Okay, so if you're near Pittsburgh, if you're near Monroeville, Big Rig Barbecue has, and we're not sponsored, we just like food. they have the best brisket grilled cheese.
Yes.
I think that's my favorite.
Hot take. If you're around on a Friday, they do a smoked wing special. Fantastic.
Like buffalo wings?
They just do them smoked with like a little dry rub on them. They're great.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Back to the podcast. thank you so much for joining us. I'm joined today by Patrick Yarborough and his wife, Lindsay. They both work at RCA Monroeville. They're such an important part of the fabric here at RCA Monroeville. And so I wanted you to hear their story. Lindsay, why don't we just start with you? Tell us a little bit about what you do here.
So I'm the outpatient administrative assistant, been here almost 3 years, and basically just provide administrative support to the outpatient department here, a lot of back-end work, but also a lot of front of office, front of house work.
And I think you're underselling or underestimating the impact you have on our outpatient patients that come in every day, and maybe they're here for PHP, which is 5 days a week, and or intensive outpatient IOP, which is 3 days a week, and you greet them and you're just that steady force that they see every single day, and you're a big part of their experience. So thank you for your work. And you also lead our family support group on Tuesday nights. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that is called TEAM, an acronym for Teaching, Encouraging, Advocating, Meeting. And that, I mean, it'll be a lot of what I talk about here, just encouraging family members to start their own recovery and just work on their own healing journey. And that's every Tuesday, 7 to 8 p.m., and that is both face-to-face and virtual.
Awesome. And I think it's interesting, and we're going to talk about And one of the reasons why I wanted to sit down with you both is because you both consider yourselves in recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you consider yourself in recovery from not drugs and alcohol, but life, right?
Yeah.
And and you've done a lot of work as a family member and the main support person for your loved one who's in recovery, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can I say it that way?
Yeah,
I think so.
And Patrick, tell us a little bit about what you do.
So yes, well, I'll say I've been with Recovery Centers of America here in Monroeville for about 2 years. I initially started as a case manager, and I spent some time working with the insurance companies and making sure that people were covered for their time with us. But now my role, and something I will say that I've been passionate about since I walked in the door of RCA as someone in recovery, is our alumni association. I am one of the alumni coordinators here at Recovery Centers of America in Monroeville. And what I do is I just work to start building connections and relationships with our patients as they come in for inpatient, or whether they go directly to outpatient. I try to get over there and just let them know early on that we are here to be a support for them. We are here to invite them and encourage them to stay engaged with patients that are still coming in through alumni meetings, through service opportunities in the community, as well as just opportunities to get together and go to events and just know that it is possible to have fun in sobriety, and let them know that we will continue to be there for them long after they've walked out the doors of RCA.
And I think peer recovery has become a real buzzword in our community, and peer mentorship in just in the medical field in general. What does it mean to have a sit down time with someone who's been in your shoes, who understands what that patient is going through? Can you talk a little bit about that relationship?
In the recovery community, you'll hear a lot about sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And as somebody who's been in the grips of alcoholism and addiction myself, and understanding just how hopeless it feels to have all the desire in the world to do something different, but to just not know how to go about it and not even know how to take the first step, it's so helpful to have somebody that can come in and share their story, and I can immediately connect to that and recognize that they've dealt with some of the same difficulties. Now, to some degree, they're different. We're all individuals. We're all different people. But at the core of it, they really understand what it means to be trapped by this substance use. But then to see that something's different now, that they were like I was, but something's changed. And then I can be encouraged to know that if it work, whatever that is working for them, then I can come alongside them and they can show me what they've done and they can pull me out of it. And there's hope in that. Mm-hmm. So, and just knowing that you have a support, someone you can reach out to, that can talk you through just life. Mm-hmm. And knowing that you're not alone, something I always like to say is we don't recover in a vacuum. We have to do it with a group of individuals around us, people that can come around us and support us. And a lot of times, especially in early recovery for me, that was somebody to love me when I wasn't ready to love myself.
And I think it becomes so important to, like, you serve as a peer mentor to our families, because it's something you walked through, Lindsay, and you serve for patients and for alums. And there's something really powerful about not having to bring shame into that relationship. And it's the first time you're really meeting, maybe it's the first time you're really meeting somebody who knows what that journey is like, knows what the, not only the activity, but the surrounding guilt and shame and stigma that people are walking through. How would you describe that?
I think just, I mean, for me, it's a privilege to over basically the past 5 years to share just what I learned through really hard times and to be able to share that with family members. And just, you know, the education and this idea of being in recovery is all stuff that I didn't have. And there were some mistakes I made early on that was just a lack of education. And so being able to share that with family members and especially get them out of that obsession of their loved one, or another way of phrasing it is being addicted to their addiction, giving them that hope in recovery for themselves as well.
Would you mind taking us back to what was early? Just tell me how you met. And let's just start there. How'd you meet?
We met at a tiny, tiny Bible college in upstate New York. I had been a student there for a couple of years already, and one of my best friends told me that his cousin was coming up like the next year to start in classes there. And he said, I'm really concerned about my cousin. I don't know how he's going to do here because he's a recovering addict. So I kind of like, I knew of this guy that was coming up to campus. Actually, Patrick was my brother's roommate for the first semester. Yeah. So a combination of being, you know, good friends with his cousin and then, you know, my brother's roommate, kind of got to know Patrick fairly quickly. Very quickly. We were dating within a month of the semester starting. So I had been warned about, you know, this guy, this addict that was coming. But you know, Patrick showed up. He was a Southern gentleman, wearing, you know, bright colored polos. And he just looked put together, and, you know, not knowing anything about addiction, you know, he didn't fit the stigmatized view of what I had of what an addict looks like. So, and aside from that, you know, we had conversations early on about his history of addiction and what that was like, and just the change that he felt his restored faith was making at that time. But even though I knew about his past, I never thought it was going to be in our future.
Did you have much experience in your upbringing?
No, zero experience in my upbringing. I was, quote unquote, the good kid in high school and didn't party and didn't mess around with anything. So, yeah, I had zero experience with addiction, alcoholism.
So you marry. Was it a pretty short engagement, courtship, all of that?
We got married a year and a half from the day we started dating.
Yeah. And so you get married. How soon is it when you're going, something feels not quite right?
I mean, actually, the first summer we were married, and this is something, I mean, we can laugh about a lot of this now, but, you know, understand that this is, you know, he's almost to 5 years. In a couple of days, he will be 5 years sober. So this has been a long healing journey that now we can laugh about some of the insanity that happened. So the first summer we were married, I was being a good newlywed wife and decided to organize his closet for him and found a bag of some herbal looking stuff. And I think in my heart, I knew what it was, but I didn't want to believe what it was. So when I confronted him, this is just the insanity of addiction. He told me that it was a tincture for keeping his clothes fresh. I thought, well, you know, some people...
Patrick.
I know, and I joke. We joke now, and I say now, like, when she was like, oh, okay, I was immediately just thinking, really? You bought that?
Yeah, and, you know, people put lavender in their clothes, so... And again, I knew, but I didn't want to believe it. So, and then things kind of progressed from there. Patrick had the mindset of, well, or he told me anyways, I was an addict, not an alcoholic. So I think it's okay for me to drink, and not knowing anything about addiction. Sure. That made sense to me. So we drank casually together. That wasn't a red flag for me, but into about 2 years or so into marriage, you know, he worked at a fast food restaurant, and afterwards he would go out with the guys for drinks. And it started to get where he was coming back later and later and later, like 4, 5 a.m. or not at all. And when I confronted him about that, you know, this is where gaslighting comes in, making me question my own reality. When I confronted him, he said, well, no, I feel like you're treating me like someone I used to be and not who I am now. And so because he kind of in his addiction dismissed it that way, I dismissed it myself. 'Cause I thought, well, I'm just the one that's overreacting, I guess.
And what's going on with you during this time?
So I came from a community where I was very tied in to recovery fellowships. I was working a strong program, and I had this idea that as I came up to Bible college, I didn't get tied back into that recovery community in this new area. And I was able to justify that by saying, well, everything about these programs is meant to deepen your understanding of what your higher power is. And I have that here, and I'm learning the Bible. I'm reading through all of these Old Testament stories about how God is faithful, and I'm building my understanding of God. And I have all of these friends around me that have the same relationship. So I don't need the fellowship. And that was my first big mistake.
So you stop going to the meetings.
Stop going to the meetings.
Relationship with sponsor?
At that point, no. My sponsor, my last sponsor was back in South Carolina. And I had one friend that happened to be in recovery. He was right across the hall from me in the dorms, and we quickly became best friends. And I just started working a lot. I was in school full time. I was volunteering in the church we were attending. And what I knew to be initially my perspective was, because of the work that I'm doing and growing closer to God, He is allowing me to be of service in these ways, quickly shifted, and my pride started coming back in, and it became, God, look at all the ways I'm serving you. And I wasn't able to catch that shift in myself. And that's where that fellowship would have been so helpful. Mm-hmm. Because these are people who have been there and have experienced it, and they could have called me on it.
That peer to peer, like, we know where this thinking leads.
And it's things that they can say to me that I won't accept from anyone else in the world because I'm stubborn and obstinate. But when it comes from them and I know the heart behind it because I've experienced what they've experienced, I just can receive things better from that person. And I didn't do it. And
so how long did you have, what was your sobriety time looking like when you?
I had about 1 year and 3 months.
Okay.
And it was within a few months of getting there and getting into this schedule that I remember the first time I had moved into an apartment by myself at the time. And I remember sitting at home at night and I was just kind of burnt out. Mm-hmm. I was going nonstop most of the week. And there was a corner store down the street. And I thought, you know what? God's, look at all the work that I'm doing for God. He's freed me of this obsession. He's freed me from all of this. I can probably have a drink. And I remember going down to the store and picking up like one 24-ounce beer and coming home and sitting down and watching TV and drinking it. And that was it. And I was like, well, I successfully drank. And gradually from that point on, even that was still during our engagement, it just kept getting worse. And everything, every thought that I had went back to how I successfully did it that one time. And that was always my focus. And looking back now, I can look back and see that the truth of it is that I either focused on controlling my drinking to the point that I was never able to enjoy it, or I gave in and drank for enjoyment and drank in excess and out of control. And those were the only two experiences that I really had in those periods of time. When I was drinking casually with her, she's thinking it's casual drinks, but in my mind, the obsession's still there, but it's the opposite. It's don't drink too much, don't drink too much, don't drink too much. You can't drink too much. You can't know that. And for the longest time, I think she had this understanding that I believed what I was saying when I was saying I'm an addict. Alcohol wasn't an issue. But the truth was, is that was already, that was the first of many lies to come of me trying to protect this relationship with alcohol, with substances.
How soon do you know this is a problem for me?
I didn't know that was a, I didn't come to terms.
You didn't feel like I've relapsed right away.
Oh, okay. That was something that I may have pushed out. I think within about 6 months, I knew within myself that there was a problem with this behavior. Mm-hmm. But the obsession was still there, and it wasn't, this is problem drinking. It was, I know I'm living in a lie. I'm hiding this from my friend who's in recovery. I'm hiding this from a campus that's actually a dry campus, but here I am drinking in my apartment. And that was still a campus apartment. So that was there from the beginning, but I was still able to tell myself, but I can get this under control.
And then you leave the college and you start working in ministry.
Yes.
Still leading this double life.
Yeah. And at that point, actually near the end of our time, while we were in New York, I had started using like THC pens, the vape pens. And by that point, I had admitted it to her and said that, well, I'm using it for pain management and her anxiety. And she accepted that and I guess to some extent allowed it, even though she never really liked it. But then we left New York. We go down to Alabama. And there was actually a clear point where I said, okay, I'm going to be working in ministry now. I have to stop all of this. And I think for about a month, I successfully did not do anything. And then we closed on a house pretty shortly after that. Because, you know, we were thinking very clear-headed. Here's me in an active alcoholism. We just moved states away from any loved ones. We've been here for a couple months to work with a church
plant. Let's buy a house.
Let's buy a house.
A church plant. Not an established church.
A plant. And then right after we bought the house, the alcohol came right back into the picture. And within a couple months of that, we closed on that house in October. And in December, my doctor, who I had just started seeing, put me back into a pain management program for pain that I've always had. That was the reason I started using opiates. And he prescribed me about 112 10 milligram Vicodin a month, which to the average person is a large amount of opiates. But to me, who was already back in an addiction with alcohol and had a history of heroin use, all that did was remind me of what I was missing. It was just enough to scratch an itch, but not enough to alleviate it. And I remember fighting to take those prescriptions correctly, or at least try to wait long enough after I took too many so it matched up.
Do you tell the doctor you have a history of substance use disorder?
The doctor did know about a past.
Yeah.
But I don't think I was 100% like I was an IV heroin addict. I said I had issues with opiates or something like that. And it was a quick, as difficult, and as I can look back and see the reality of the alcohol use through that time and how problematic it was, there was no denying the problem once the opiates were added back to it. I quickly lost control. The first month, I successfully kept pills at least near the end of the prescription. But quickly after that, it became I was out in 2 weeks. I was out in 2 weeks again. And then I would be the last month that I picked up that prescription. That entire prescription was gone in 4 or 5 days.
Lindsay, what are you experiencing at this time?
A lot of denial and just ignorance about what was going on. I mean, I knew he was prescribed the Vicodin, but actually, I didn't realize it was actually Vicodin for a long time. It was oxycodone acetaminophen. So that didn't, to me, like, I knew it was a painkiller. I didn't know it was Vicodin. And I think it was after the first incident where he was in a car accident that he said, well, I don't know if I want to tell a doctor this because I actually wasn't supposed to be drinking on this medication. And I don't want him to stop prescribing it. And that was news to me that, wait, you weren't supposed to be drinking this whole time. And there's something else. Just lost it. But just a lot of ignorance, like a lot of red flags that I didn't catch because I didn't know it was an issue.
And so when does it come to the point where you're no longer able to put it under the, there's no denying it?
So the first kind of halfway wake-up call was that car accident where now I know, okay, he's been abusing his pills and he's not supposed to be drinking. And so we got rid of all the alcohol in the house, and this is where ignorance came into play. I don't want him to stop taking the Vicodin, because if he stops getting it from a doctor, he'll probably just go find it on the streets. And he's in pain. And even when I found out he was using the THC pen, that was, I bought into his sob story of, I just use it for my pain. But I bought into all of those lies that were fed me for a while. And so my major wake up call, though, was that I was in, this was April of 2019. I was in the hospital for a planned video EEG, and I was there for a week, and Patrick was acting really strange that week, just falling asleep, even when the doctors were in the room. I didn't recognize that as nodding off, or just when he was awake, was like just moving and shuffling around and like unnecessarily organizing things. And then one night I kind of said, just sit down. And he got mad and, you know, left the room, went out to get some food around the streets of the hospital. When he came back in, he went into the bathroom and I heard a collapse. So I, again, one thing when I talk to family members is just the importance of education on overdose. And even just on these signs that I missed that he was using that week. But then I witnessed this overdose when I found him, you know, on the floor of the bathroom, and I didn't know what it was. So I just picked up the nurse call button and just said, I need some help in here. And actually, I was more concerned about the cost of what the hospital bill might be for him, because I just was so clueless. So a couple rounds of nurses came in, and then finally they see him turning purple and realize he's not breathing, and code blue is called, oxygen tank gets taken off the wall, chest compressions. I hear them saying like not breathing or no pulse, but I didn't understand that for several minutes Patrick was actually medically dead. And they didn't even Narcan him, because they also didn't recognize it or have enough information to know it was an overdose, but they were able to revive him, get him into the ER. And by that next morning, I found out that they had found heroin in his system. And so then I knew, oh, okay, so this is really serious. Now it's not just drinking or abusing his prescription. Now he found heroin. And that's especially talking to my parents' pastor that's in recovery. I kind of took some advice like, okay, he needs to go to rehab and he needs to get some help now. And so he did. He decided to go into this 30-day program that was a part of the hospital he was at.
Take us to that moment. How do you get starting a church plant, working in ministry, to the bathroom floor?
It is very easy in my addiction, in my alcoholism, to separate the two. That I'm able to convince myself, and the truth is lie to myself. And that's the hardest part of this, is because for the longest time I was feeding her lies. But the truth is the first person I was lying to was myself the entire time. There were multiple instances where I would attempt to get some type of substance while I was under the influence of alcohol. I would try to get something else and would wake up the next day and go, well, that was stupid. I'll never do that again. And believe it. And not realize how close to the edge and over the edge I already was. And working in this church plant, and I was just able to separate. I was able to always put the line in the sand that was too far a little bit farther away every time. So I'm abusing these Vicodin, I'm drinking, but I'm still telling myself, but I'm not using heroin, the pills are coming from my doctor. I can buy the alcohol down the street. That's okay. And at the same time, knowing it's a problem. Mm. I'm still doing good work in ministry. I've had opportunities to preach sermons, and I'm still sharing my testimony with people that I meet in public. And that's kind of the insanity of it, is that week while she was in the hospital, I was working, again, I was still working as a manager for a local fast food restaurant while also working at the church, because it's a plant and there's, mm-hmm. there's no salary yet. So I was working and then had the house to myself and driving out to UAB to see her. And I picked up my prescription early on in that week. And just, I was at the end. There wasn't any more control or fight left in me. I do remember multiple times when I would be driving to work, and I mean, listening to worship songs on the radio and in full tears, like, God, you got to take this away. Mm-hmm. You got to. And everything I knew about the 12 steps already, like, I'm sitting here asking God to remove this. And I know that process. Mm-hmm. And I know what I need to do. But I, like, it had so far been removed from me that everything was still caught up in pride and ego. And I was terrified to just get honest, because I felt like I had built up a reputation. And if I started to get honest, people would start to value me the same way I was valuing myself. So the week that she was in the hospital, I was taking way more pills than I had been before. And by that weekend, I had depleted the entire supply. And the night in question, that was when I finished up those pills, where she had yelled at me to sit down because I was in a manic state from opiates. And I went out to get dinner for us. And even that night, sharing my testimony in complete insanity, I was talking to a homeless person, and I was talking about how powerful our God is that, and that he had removed this heroin addiction from me. And his response was, I can get some heroin. And immediately, even though I had just told him that that had been removed from me, I said, well, call him. And I remember picking it up and going, and actually the whole time I'm getting messages, where are you? This is taking forever, because now I'm sitting down at a Burger King down the street waiting on this guy's dealer to show up, and I'm making up excuses on the phone. And I get back up to her hospital room and we argue some more about something I don't even know. And I remember going into the bathroom and snorting half of what I had. And the only thought that I remember having was, that tasted like heroin. Oh. And then my next memory is waking up in the ER the next day.
How does it feel hearing that back?
I mean, I've heard his story and his perception a lot. I'm early on, though, when he would share what happened, there was a lot of just distortion in what he was sharing. And he would tell me things and I would say, no, you know, the argument wasn't about, you know, this is what happened. And there's been a lot that we've worked through that, you know, family members often say, well, they don't even really remember what happened. And I'll, you know, say, well, yes, but still their perspective and their reality can't just be dismissed. You know, that they have different perceptions, but what's important is that you guys come together and focus on a solution. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's what we've been able to do that I've stopped focusing on all the ways he was wrong and just ways that we could get better.
And that's a tough shift.
Yeah.
It did not happen then, by the way. It didn't. Let's not...
You don't instantly go from... No. Well, and you've got to be scared.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have... It's not like you grew up where this was, you know, a lot of people around you were dealing with addiction and overdose. And this is your first time through, right?
Yeah. I remember just being in shock. I remember when I did go home when he was out of the hospital and in rehab, just staring at the wall, like not even with the TV on, just sitting in the living room, staring at the wall, like in shock, like, how did my life get here? How did this happen? And just a lot of tears, a lot of just feeling hopeless.
And you're in a strange city.
Yes.
Not a lot of no family.
No family in town. Yeah. Okay.
And you wake up, and what's the first memory?
I wake up, and my first memory is, I'm probably caught. How do I get out of this? I actually remember when I woke up, the senior pastor of this plant that was a friend of her family's and had become a friend of mine, he was sitting next to me and he was like, he just had a look on his face. And the first thing I did, because I have breathing tubes down my throat, I can't speak. So I asked for a sheet of paper and without any prompting at all, and the insanity, and I can laugh about it now because I can go, how ridiculous was this? But without any prompting, all I wrote on the sheet of paper was, it wasn't heroin. And I love him because his response back to me was, are you stupid? And he said that, and I can still hear all the compassion in his voice when he did it.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I ever outright admitted that it was heroin. I don't know that there ever came a time for, at least until I was in treatment. I think I said it wasn't. A nurse basically came in and said, no, yeah, it was.
And they do, you know... By that point, they've confirmed. And what was it?
So, yes, it was heroin, but it was also carfentanil.
Which is deadly, completely deadly.
Yeah.
And we're blessed to have you here.
I remember in the ER the next morning, one of the nurses or doctors saying to him, you got to stop. You're lucky to be here. Mm-hmm. And even for me, that's when I realized how serious it was too.
Yeah. So you're pack up and ready to go to rehab at that point?
Oh yeah, totally. No.
you're still not quite.
I had no fight in me for recovery. But somehow I always had the fight to push back against the people that were in my life. I think by the time I agreed to go to treatment and I went in the same facility where I overdosed, but it was not because I was ready for recovery. I did it to appease my family, which, by the way, they were there so fast. I mean, by the time I came to in the ER, my mother and stepfather who lived in Atlanta were there. My father and stepmom, who were all the way on the East Coast, North Carolina, were there. And very shortly after all of them, my cousin, who heard about it, drove in from Atlanta as well. And they were all there and just trying to let me know that they cared about me. And I just couldn't receive that because I was in such a dark place. As much as I regret it, I know the first moment that Lindsay and I were alone in a room since the overdose. My family had stepped out in the hall and she just said, "What are you thinking right now?" And my response was, "Honestly, I'm mad that you called the nurses. I'd much rather be dead."
What's that like to hear?
I think more than anything, I was kind of angry with his reasoning.
Yeah.
And I, at that point, just the trauma of what I'd been through was like, I didn't have much room for compassion in my heart. So I think I just felt like,
you've got to start feeling like, okay, I've really been betrayed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I just felt angry. Like, are you kidding me right now? Like, you're lucky to be alive. You want to be dead? Like, you should be grateful for your life. But it did kind of too feel like blaming me. Like you should have just let me die, or, you know, I'm miserable anyways. I don't know. I remember too, that the other hurtful thing that happened in the hospital was that we had no plan for relapse. Again, I still never really thought it was going to happen. And I remember, like, the hospital gave us some resources for local rehab facilities and whatever else. But I just was holding this list. And I think with his mom or stepmom, we were going through and trying to figure out what should he do. And like mentioned something to him. And he said, "That's a three-quarter house, not a rehab." And he was acting out of his withdrawal at that time. But I just like broke down because I had no idea what to do with that. And one thing,
and there's a lot of, like, we use terms like PHP, housing, like all the medical terminology that goes along with treatment is all new.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely different world that we had to walk into.
And what did you ultimately decide?
After hours of just resistance, kicking and screaming, I agreed to go back into rehab. And luckily, like I had mentioned, there was, they had an inpatient program within the facility that I was in. Mm-hmm. And of course, I made the mistake that most people are going to want to make in that situation. And I fought going and being directly admitted. I wanted to go home one last night and get my stuff together and get things in order, even though I had all the family around that could have just brought it to me. And the smartest move would have been to go directly over. But I still had to win something, I guess. And even my first few weeks in treatment, I just wasn't ready. I remember I spent at least a week and a half or 2 weeks grieving alcohol like I just had a best friend die. Like I was laying a friend to rest. And it was, I don't understand it. Today, I can't understand it. I know the feeling associated with it, but because the truth of it is the idea that I was grieving was never a reality to begin with, because the idea was I'll never be able to just have a beer and enjoy a barbecue. But I'd never done that in my life. Every time I drank for effect. The few times that I had had one beer, I didn't enjoy it because everything became, I have to stop now because I need to be normal. And normal people don't think like that. But I had to go through that process. And I think the turning point in treatment was as somebody who had been through the program before and knew what the program had to offer, I found it so difficult to swallow my pride and walk back into a meeting. And I actually, luckily enough, the facility that I was in took us to outside meetings. And there was a great tech in that building who would not let me say no to anything. I actually remember a day into my treatment, I was laying in bed for a group. And a tech came in and said, it's time for group. And I pulled the whole, I don't feel good. And he shut the door. Next thing I know, I hear that door kick back open. And this little old lady walked in and said, you get out of bed right now and you go to group. And I did not like her for a couple of days. I love her to death now. But again, we're going to a meeting tonight. And I was like, I don't want to go. She was like, I don't care. You're going. And the whole way there, I remember just the feeling like there was static in my body. It just, I was so nervous about having to go back into these rooms. And mind you, this is a city I've never been to in recovery in. I don't know any of the people in this room. It's not like I'm walking in and seeing my old sponsor.
And are you resisting the work that you know is ahead, the surrender? Is it just this battle for giving up your own will? What's the main crux there?
The truth is, what I know it to be now is I was resisting the shattering of this false appearance or perspective that I wanted others to have of myself.
And if you admit you have this problem and you've had it a long time, people will know.
Yeah. And for me, something that's always been a core of my belief is I developed my own value in being the person that could figure it out on my own. I hated asking for help. I needed to be somebody who could do it on their own in everything. And I didn't view myself that way. That, you know, my self-esteem didn't tell me I can do it all and I don't need help.
I've heard you talk a little bit about the theology replacing kind of the work of recovery. Can you explain that again?
Yes. What I understood is the lies I told myself when I got to Bible college was this idea that, well, I'm reading the Bible, I'm learning about God, and what I'm missing in all of that and what I was just blinded to, and again, I will always attribute it to my own pride, was there was no amount of knowing of God that can replace the knowing God and being known by Him, which is a relationship. And that relationship is something that I initially found in the 12 steps as somebody who grew up in the church. And my teen years and how I felt like to be a Christian meant to walk into church and put a smile on your face and say, everything's okay, and volunteer and cook at the spaghetti dinners and go on missions trips. And then the rest of the week was mine. And then when I got into a 12-step program and I started to develop and hear a message for the first time that was, this is about a relationship and having a personal experience with God, that my life changed. And that's where I made this shift. And then so quickly I fell right back out of that, that it became, how can I learn more about God? How can I eloquently explain it to other people, that as my own pride and sense of self puffed up larger and larger and larger, it just separated me from that connection. I lost the connection and the actual deeper relationship behind it. I knew it was there. There was never a point at that time where I never thought He wasn't there. I just couldn't feel Him anymore. And that's always been the fight, is learning how to crush that outward appearance of myself. Because again, inwardly, I don't feel that way. And I think that's what was so hard about walking back into the rooms, about accepting the help and the love of my family when I was in that hospital room, was if I start to accept this, then I have to truly give in and say that I need help. And the second I do that, people are going to start valuing me the same way I value myself.
And what was that?
Nothing. That I was, if I couldn't do it on my own, then I was useless to them.
And so you're going through this. He's had this overdose. He's agreed to a 30-day treatment. And what are you thinking at this point? That he's going to come home and all's going to be well? Or
that he is not coming home.
Okay. So somebody's talked to you that that there's a process here. Are you starting to get that picture? Or is it just kind of the anger, the betrayal, you're kind of done?
Yeah, I think by that point I remember sitting with my pastor talking about kind of what was going on. And part of what happened in those 32 days or 30, however many days, was that what we call it in family groups, I started playing the detective, started investigating. There's an obsession around that too, for the family member. I was looking through stuff, which to some extent we needed to do to make sure the house was safe for him. But I also, you know, figured out how to get into his Facebook and started looking through messages. And I found out that this was not just a little slip up because of the painkillers, that this, for the 3 years of our marriage at that time, he had been doing, like, even, you know, smoking weed without me knowing, or the drinking was a lot worse than I knew. And then especially what was hurtful was every time we were visiting his hometown, he was contacting old friends to try to pick something up. So that just added a whole new layer of just the betrayal and betrayal trauma that as a family member, I really was hesitant to call it trauma because you say trauma and you think of witnessing a death or something, that's trauma. But trauma is also somebody that is supposed to be there, a trust-built relationship. When that trust is broken or abused, that is a form of trauma or a form of what's called betrayal trauma. And so just going through all of that, I got to this place of, I'm not ready for him to come home until I can trust him again. Mm-hmm. So I got to that point, and people at his facility were talking to me about outpatient, and they, he was telling me about sober living houses, but I had no idea what that really meant. Like you said, that terminology was foreign to me. So when I heard outpatient, I heard, well, he's going to go back to work. And that's about all I heard. And I knew that he had been getting benzos or other drugs from people at work. So my thought is, heck no, he's not going back to work. And he's definitely not coming home here. And so the more counsel I got, I had some people directly tell me, Lindsay, go home, go be with your parents. And so what I ended up doing was I did move back up here to Pittsburgh and moved in with my parents. And I wrote a letter explaining everything I had found out and asked, this is where we disagree. For me, it was asking him to come up to Pennsylvania and to go through a year-long Christian program. In Patrick's perception, it was an ultimatum of if he didn't, I was going to get a divorce. And that's something, again, in 5 years that we've worked through is getting to this point of being able to accept, like I kind of already talked about, we had different perspectives around the same events. And it's not about who's right or wrong or even what the facts are. It's about our different experiences around that and that we can accept that and accept each other in that.
So you're getting ready to leave 30 days and you get a letter saying what you felt was you got to do this 1 year and you're not coming home.
Yeah. And it was more than that in that letter. It was a tough letter to read. But yeah, it was near probably about a week, maybe a week and a half before the end of my stay. On a Sunday, I was given a letter from the nursing station. Come to find out that this letter was actually dropped off on Friday with specific instruction not to give it to me until Sunday.
I didn't want you to try to stop.
Yeah. So I opened up this letter, and it was a complete recount of all of these messages where I had been attempting to get drugs in the past, and things that to me at that point really I never even considered, because in my view of them, they were attempts, but they weren't successful. So it didn't count. Nothing. It's nothing. It didn't count. I didn't use. I just tried to. But I never thought about them. And then it talked about how I had broken the trust. And she didn't know how she could trust me, or how she could live with me if she didn't trust me. And the best way for me to build trust again would be to go to this year-long program. So I read that and said, well, this is saying you can't live with me if you can't trust me, and the only way you'll trust me is if I do this. So I remember I called her, and we had conversations. And
sounds like they might have been heated.
They were a little heated.
They were arguments. Conversation is a nice word.
They weren't conversations. They were arguments.
It was very straightforward. This is an ultimatum. Is this, like, I just wanted her to admit that this was an ultimatum. And I fought, because I at that point, I had opened back up to the idea of meetings. When I made it to my first one, there was a revelation of peace in it. As terrified as I was to go, I got there and just felt home. So I was committed again. And like at that moment, I became committed to my recovery again. And I had ideas. I had a plan of action for my recovery.
And didn't include a year-long program.
And it was not this program, and it was not in Pennsylvania. So I felt really hurt. And I think a lot of it almost was like, this is all of my fear about how she's going to value me come to light.
So you're feeling...
I was right. Of course she feels like I'm useless and nothing.
You're feeling a little bit of abandonment. And she's finally, for the first time, feeling like, okay, I've set my foot down. I'm feeling a little bit of strength.
Yeah, and even though, you know, I would have done things differently. One of my biggest regrets is choosing a program for him, because I now realize the importance of letting him have say in his recovery and what works best for him. But I am still proud of myself for getting to that place of setting a boundary for myself.
Yeah.
So, and making the decision that was right for me.
So you go.
I go. Not happily. And I think a big part of it is I didn't know how well this was going to work out. I had questions about their program, and they were missing some key aspects in their program that I knew was helpful for me. They didn't really incorporate 12 steps into it. And for me, I was like, this is what works. Like, this is how I've gotten sober. This is how I've had this relationship with God in the past. And that's what's kept me sober. The program wasn't flawed. I was flawed in my execution of it last time. And they didn't have that. And there were things that, and then just a year, it seemed so
daunting.
Much. And it's out of state, and it means I'm losing my job, and we have a mortgage, and we have all these things. And I was just terrified of what that meant, which what it meant was just blowing up my life as I knew it.
It was that last string.
Yeah.
that facade.
It was it was everything. And then come to find out, then we had conversations, and to recognize that I'm at that point experiencing what she had already felt, because I'm saying this is going to blow up our life as I know it. And her thought is, you already blew up our life as I knew it. And again, I made the commitment to go, but it wasn't for that program. I made that commitment for my marriage. And even at that time, it wasn't even a commitment to Lindsay. I just came to a place where I said, this is a commitment that I've made to God. And if I'm going to work a program that's based off of living out His will in my life, this is where it starts.
Yeah.
And I went, and we both agree now, it was a very hard year for both of us. Mm-hmm. I struggled a lot in that facility with depression. I don't think I really did much growing in my recovery. I really treated it like a prison sentence. I was just doing a bid. But I knew what I was still committed to on the outside. Mm-hmm. And I did as much as I could to start working that as quickly as I could. But it was
a tough time.
It was not easy.
Talk to me a little bit about your recovery, Lindsay. And I know we talk a lot about, you know, individuals who are experiencing substance use disorder getting in recovery, but what does it look like for someone to be in recovery for life?
Yeah. So I had just hit my absolute lowest point in life too. While he is going through this program, I'm living with my parents in their basement. My mom always gets frustrated when I say living in their basement, because it wasn't like a cellar. It was a nice basement, but regardless, I'm an adult married woman that had to move back in with mom and dad. I had to scrap both of our old cars before I went. And this year that I'm living with my mom and dad, I'm continuing to pay the mortgage on this house. That is the worst decision of our lives, was that house. Anyways, in this breaking point, I'm still, for a long time, stuck in anger and bitterness and just hate, really, is what it was to for him and the situation and at addiction. And somebody suggested to me, you should maybe try out Celebrate Recovery, because everyone is in recovery there. And I didn't like that idea. But I went to this Celebrate Recovery meeting, and Celebrate Recovery is just a Christian 12-step meeting. We use the exact same 12 steps. But people go for anything and everything, anger, codependency.
The motto is hurts, habits, and hangups, yes, right?
Yeah. Healing from your hurts, habits, and hangups. And so I went to this meeting and heard people referring to themselves as, hi, I'm Joe. I'm a believer that struggles with anger or whatever. And that was really strange to me, that these people that didn't struggle with drug addiction or alcohol were saying, I'm in recovery. And I remember going home to my dad and saying, I don't know how I feel about this. Everyone's in recovery, but I think that's probably why I need to keep going back. And Al-Anon or Nar-Anon teach the same thing, that family members, friends can all be in recovery, use the same 12 steps, just for healing from any life issues, period. And it took a little while to get out of that mindset of, I don't need recovery. Patrick needs recovery. He's the one that has the issues. But the more I kept going to these meetings, the more the focus shifted off of Patrick. One of the guidelines in Celebrate Recovery sharing is keep your sharing focused on your own thoughts and feelings, not someone else's. I could still talk and share about what I was going through, but ultimately the focus had to come back to me and, my struggles and how I could improve. And that's where things started to get better for me.
This couldn't be a, I get to come in this room and complain about Patrick's, look at all the bad things Patrick's done.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. And I remember being in an Al-Anon meeting and just afterwards, like, trying to vent to this lady that was there. And she just kind of gently said, like, redirected it back to me or something. And I remember kind of like this frustration of, why isn't anyone letting me just vent and dump? And, you know, I eventually found a friend where I could do some of that with, but these recovery meetings were so important to shift that focus back onto me.
Yeah. And you start finding community in other family members who are,
yes.
And so, other people whose families are experiencing the same thing.
The first friend, the friend I mentioned, her husband had about a year and some months of recovery at that point. And when I met her, and my mom had already pointed her out to me at church, so I kind of knew her history. And when I met her and mentioned, yeah, my husband's going through this, she said to me, you know, I live every day learning how to be okay if tomorrow he's not okay. And that, like, that's blew my mind. Yeah. And even with a year, like, her husband was like this perfect picture of recovery to me. That idea, and I still live by that motto today, that I need to be okay and live every day, one day at a time, learning to be okay if tomorrow Patrick isn't okay. Because that's the nature of this disease of addiction, is that, you know, 5 years in, Patrick could still relapse tonight, tomorrow. I don't live in fear of that, but I do live in awareness of that.
That's a really, I love that. I don't live in fear, but I live in awareness.
Yeah.
That's really good. That's good advice. What's life like now? You guys have done a lot of work. It's going to be 5 years this
Sunday.
Congratulations to you both. I mean, and I'm sure it doesn't sound like it's been easy, but it sounds like it's been worth it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I will say it's never easy. I mean, that's not what we were promised in this life, mm-hmm. but it's gotten better. And through every difficulty we've had, we've grown closer together. We've grown closer to God. And we learn something about each other, and we learn something about how we're able to persevere.
Yeah.
And I'll add that, you know, we were in marriage counseling for his second year where he was interning in this program. We lived separately for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And
so you went 1 year to the program and then you stayed?
And then I interned.
Wow.
He interned at their Pittsburgh location for the second year. And during that year, we were able to start doing some marriage counseling. Mm-hmm. And I found that towards the end of that second year, the focus shifted from it being on him and her kind of getting us out of that crisis to back onto me. And she started talking to me about emotional intimacy and the importance. She talked to both of us about it, mm-hmm. the importance of rebuilding trust and having emotional intimacy. Because now that we were out of crisis, we needed to learn how to trust each other again. But even more than that, how to be better than we were before, to communicate better and be connected on a different level. And so that's been a lot of intentional work of not just, you know, chatting about, you know, how was your day? Oh, it was good. But, you know, when we share these stories to prompt, well, how did that interaction with that coworker make you feel? Or, you know, what was that emotion on the deeper level? Or, you know, what do you think you could do tomorrow to maybe make that better? It is intentional. It's still intentional today. It's like, sometimes it's like, this is a lot of work. Like, can't we just talk about work without having to talk about feelings?
And you chose to work together too, in the same building. That adds another level. I mean, and we're grateful to have you both here. You share that you're still working through things and you still, you shared with a group yesterday, so that you still go to counseling, that you still work on this day after day.
Yeah, we still, every other week now, because again, we're not in crisis, we're in maintenance now.
Yeah.
But that's, and even maintenance isn't the right word for it. It's just, you know, it's continued work.
Part of what you do.
Where, you know, maintenance can imply that we're, you know, kind of just staying where we are.
And what's it like to share openly that, yes, we're in recovery? I mean, that was kind of your fear. Your greatest fear was that honesty.
Yeah.
And now you live in that radical honesty.
Yeah. And that's part of it is in my own pride and in my own ego, when I get outside of the will of God, my life becomes, I've got to be able to do this. I've got to be strong enough. But what I come to every time in my recovery is, you know, I can't get past step one until I recognize that I'm powerless. And it's not powerless over drugs or alcohol. You know, that's a symptom of the problem. I'm powerless over my life and my ability to control and manage situations outside of myself. So that, and I look at it and I think about all the things that I've done even before. I was a liar and a manipulator to my wife, and I cared more about my own comfort than her emotional security. And these were all terrible things. And I was even worse years before. And today, I have to think, if I lived a life in that way, I need to be able to see some good come out of it. And no good can come out of it unless I'm open and honest and share what that was like, so people can know that there's a way out of it.
I like that. I really want, and we're going to have a part two.
Okay.
Or three, whatever. So if you guys are willing, I would love to sit down with you again. Talk about the backstory. This was kind of that second time through recovery. Mm-hmm. Love to hear kind of how your journey into addiction started and childhood stuff, and if you're willing to share that.
I can share on some of that.
All right. So thank you so much for being with us. We always end with favorite recovery quote.
Okay.
What you got?
I always want to think I can find something else, but it's true. I spoke to my wife about this, and she's like, this is always yours. Yeah, I hear you say it all the time. And it's a quote from Recovery Material on page 64. And it says, it is important not to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of our addiction. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And to me, it's as simple as somebody who's been in and out of the rooms, I have to persevere. That I am not staying sober today based off of what I did yesterday. That I have to continue to engage and pursue this manner of living so that I continue to live in accordance and with the power of my higher power.
It's really good. Do you have one, Lindsay?
Yeah, for me, it's the Serenity Prayer, but there's actually a full version. And you know, partially this is mine just because I also came to a place of realizing I was powerless, and the Serenity Prayer definitely embraces that same idea. So past the God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Oh my goodness, I'm pausing.
The courage to
change the things I can.
And the wisdom,
and the wisdom to know the difference. It continues to living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did, the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it.
Ooh, that's good.
Yeah.
Not as I would have it.
Yeah. Yeah, I never would have had addiction, but honestly, five years later, I look back on it and I'm grateful for what Patrick's addiction has where it has brought us now.
Thank you both for sharing with us today, for your vulnerability, for your honesty. It means so much. Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. If you or someone you know needs help, we have people standing by that can talk to you. Please call 1-833-RCA-ALUM. Have a great day is our hope for you.
Thank you for listening to the Strength and Recovery Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please tap the subscribe button and leave us a review. We love hearing from our listeners and hope to reach more of you out there as we continue to share these incredible stories of recovery. The RCA alumni team aims to provide a safe, supportive environment for those in the recovery community, regardless of their affiliation with RCA. We host a full calendar of virtual and in-person meetings, as well as free sober events every month. To learn more about what we do, find us at rcaalumni.com. Remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, pick up the phone and dial 1-833-RCA-ALUM. Help is available 24/7. Listen to another episode now, or join us next time for the Strength in Recovery Podcast.